Really, well, there's a lot of good podcasts. I try not to listen to any of them.
The CMU Podcast, in association with 7 Digital.
This week, HMV, Enemies of Music, and Facebook. It's the CMU Podcast, looking back at the last week in the music business. I am Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris Cook.
Hello.
How you doing?
I've had your cold all week.
It's not my cold.
It has an Andy Malt virus feel about it.
Everyone's had a cold.
And it's been a really busy week for me talking. I've been doing a lot of talking, and it's quite hard talking.
Talking to people?
At people.
Well, you probably caught it off one of them.
No, I had the cold before that.
Oh,
I had
right,
the cold all weekend
before
talking, and then it's
quite... You could have got it from anywhere.
It's quite hard talking when you sort of, half the time you're wanting to sniff, and the other half the time you're trying to want to blow your nose. And that doesn't really look very good when you're sort of standing up in front of a room of people talking, does it? I want to sniff now.
You should... What my daughter does is just lets it all flow down her face.
Well, that
until someone else comes and cleans it up, so maybe you could do that.
I don't get colds that run. So it's not that if I don't sniff, it will run. It's just if I don't sniff, it feels weird.
If you didn't sniff, I bet it would run.
I don't get those sort of colds. I mean, different people get different sorts of colds. You should know this.
I don't think...
Do your nose run?
I don't think you've done... Well, I don't know, because I've not done the full research.
I reckon. Well, perhaps if your daughter's colds run, then that means either your colds run or your wife's colds run.
She doesn't sniff or blow her nose. Gosh, that doesn't occur to her.
My nose wouldn't run if I didn't sniff. It's just that it's sort of I get increasingly bunged up.
I think it would.
Is the point.
This is a nice way to start, isn't it?
It is. Well, different people get different kinds of colds.
What kind of colds do you get?
This is science. You know, I'm trying to shift. I'm bored of music. I want to do a podcast about science. That's what I'm interested in at the moment.
I know, keep saying.
And this is me slowly, you know. We're basically now talking about science. This is a scientific conversation that we're having.
Of sorts.
Although,
yes.
If we do a podcast about science,
yeah.
I don't actually want it to go into medical science.
Because no, you're quite squeamish, aren't you?
Very squeamish. So we can talk about any elements of science, but not if it's medical. So therefore, colds are actually off the agenda. So let's not do science today.
Okay, well, this requires a complete rethink. Let's just do the normal podcast this week.
We'll do what you've planned this week.
Yeah.
And maybe I'll come up with something scientific next week that isn't medical and isn't really about evolution, which I suggested it might be. I'm a bit bored of evolution. So I'll have a think. I'll have a think about what scientific topics we could talk about on next week's podcast.
Okay, well, I look forward to that. On this week's podcast, we are going to look at who might be the music industry's enemy number one in 2017. And we also answer another of your questions. That's you listeners, not Chris. But first, let's talk about how HMV Canada has collapsed.
Yes.
Because it has.
His master's voice is back in the news. I think I said on the podcast, and if I didn't say it on the podcast, I definitely said it somewhere to someone, that it felt like, whereas after the collapse of HMV UK in the early 2013, 4 years ago now.
Blimey, yeah.
When HMV all went under. And then this company called Hilco bought it out of administration, but then shut down about half the stores, but kept a lot more open than we were expecting at the time. And then after that, bearing in mind that came at the end of, you know, every couple of years, what was it, sort of Woolworths went, and then Borders went, and then Virgin Megastore. What did it become?
Zavvi,
that was it. I mean, a shrewd move on Branson's part, encourage a management buyout, change it into a ridiculous name, so then it was Zavvi that went under, not the Virgin Megastore. And so all of these record shops went out of business. And of course, we had about 10 years where every year we were losing certainly tens of independent record shops. It was probably a couple of years where it was getting closer. Well, I suppose FOP went. I mean, HMV bought some of the stores and kept the brand, but FOP went. And there was another one. What was the other one called? Music Zone? Oh, MCV. MCV?
MVC.
MVC. MCV's a computing industry magazine. Or gaming industry magazine. Yes. So we had 10 years where basically it was just constantly record shop shutting, chain shutting, indie shop shutting. How depressing is this? All ended with the HMV collapse. And then after that, felt like you had a few years of a bit of stability in high street retail, certainly here in the UK. In the HMV reopened and they sort of shuffled their stores, they shut some down. In some towns, they moved, didn't they? Because HMV used to have quite prime sites.
Yeah, their strategy was to go for cheap rents. And if they couldn't negotiate a cheap rent where they were already, they went somewhere where they could find it.
There was that one story, which I'm not sure we ever found out was true, It was the local newspaper in whichever town it was reporting, where they'd gone to a shopping centre and said, oh, basically it'll be good promo, that old line that the artists always get. It'd be great for you to have a record shop in your shopping centre, so you should give it us for free, because we'll get people into your shopping centre. So all of that happened. He had a period of actually, it seemed that High Street was doing all right. I mean, it wasn't a cash cow business anymore, because CD sales were still slipping year on year. And DVD sales started to tank. But then you had the vinyl revival, and that certainly helped the independent shops.
And HMV's talked that up quite a lot and sort of tried to claim responsibility for the vinyl revival at one point.
And there was a couple of years where actually, rather than us writing about record shops shutting, independent record shops were opening, or like, you know, a couple were opening new stores, or there were some which were sort of...
Around the corner from my house, there are two independent record shops opposite each other.
Yes, but you do live in Hackney-by-the-Sea, so...
Still.
that's why that's happening. But, so we had a couple of years of shops opening, and obviously you had people like Urban Outfitters, who sort of ramped up the vinyl they were selling, and then various other retailers started selling CDs. I mean, not a huge collection, but a few, I mean, there was that stat, wasn't there, about 18 months ago from the Entertainment Retailers Association, that bizarrely more shops were now selling CDs than at any point in history because, well, BHS, before it went under, yeah, they were selling CDs. The supermarkets, having for a while looked like they were going to give up on music entirely, sort of ramped up their CD stocks again, and then they moved into vinyl. And it felt like for a while things were a bit stable. I think there were various reasons for that. First of all, they closed that VAT loophole, didn't they?
Yes.
So the VAT loophole that existed here that meant that online sellers, so like Amazon and HMV Online and the supermarkets online operations, and of course Play.com.
Of course.
Let's not forget Play.com. They all had that thing where if you based your operation on the Channel Islands, you didn't have to charge VAT, providing the products you were selling were less than a certain sum of money. It was like, yeah, £18 or something, wasn't it? So CDs always fell under that. So it meant they automatically had a 20% advantage over anybody on the high street. And that was a loophole that should never have been there. And that was one of my favourite things we've ever reported on, because I love the fact that for all those years when Play.com were exploiting this loophole, and it was like, no, we're not exploiting a loophole. We're based in the Channel Islands because it's nice here. It's nice being, yeah, by the sea. We like it here. Nothing to do with the VAT loophole. And then finally, George Osborne shut the VAT loophole, closed the VAT loophole, I suppose you say. So that 20% advantage no longer existed. And Play.com shut down the next week. So we're not in business, so we don't have that loophole. So that went. That helped the high street. The vinyl revivals you keep alluding to, I think that helped the high street. And also there was a bit of last man standing, wasn't there? That I suppose there were too many record shops, a lot closed, but for the ones that left, there was just about enough people still buying CDs or vinyl or whatever to keep them in business. And Rough Trade seemed to be expanding, didn't they? I mean, not in a stupid over-the-top way, but they were slowly opening other stores, yeah, elsewhere. But I sort of sense in the last 12 months that sort of period of stability is starting to come to an end. And I suppose CD sales continue to decline. People like the supermarkets and Amazon have really gone into the vinyl revival, so the independents don't have the dominance there that perhaps they once did. Also, direct-to-fan is really taking off. And that's, you know, that's awful, because we keep telling artists and labels that they should be capitalising on direct-to-fan. But I know some indie record shops say, don't they?
Well, that was when Avalanche in Edinburgh shut down. He laid into direct-to-fan.
Yeah, the guy who owned that.
Kind of, yeah, undercutting record shops by selling direct to your fans before you've released the record and things like that.
Yeah, he had various examples where people would come into the shop saying, oh, I've heard there's a new whatever band box set, can I buy that? And it was like, yeah, you can only get that on the website. They're not going to give it for us for another month. And we all know that the 2,000 people in the UK who will buy that expensive, they'll all have it within a month, and then we can only get it when it's no use. So direct-to-fan is starting to become a competitor, and artists and labels are getting a lot better at that now. So you do sort of feel that perhaps there is unease in the air again. And a few more really good indies like Avalanche, also Ripping Records in Edinburgh, have gone in the last couple of years. HMV here in the UK are constantly sort of reshuffling their stores. It doesn't really get much coverage in the national press, but if you keep an eye on the local press, the local newspapers. Quite a lot of them are, oh, they've moved their store, or this, they've shut some but opened some other. They completely pulled out of Ireland last year. Not that that was a particularly big network of stores ever, even
No, and even when HMV UK and Ireland got taken over, there was a question over whether they'd keep the Irish stores then.
And they also, this Hilco company also owned a DVD business in Ireland, and so for a while they combined that, so these extra Vision stores had HMV aisles in them, but then they shut down both of those businesses in Ireland. So it feels like high street retail is back in a slightly tricky place, and there are still some independents that are doing perfectly well, and I think that depends on their approach and where they're based. You know, there are certain parts of London and Manchester and Margate which can sustain a record shop, providing they keep their costs down and they don't do silly expansion and stuff like that. But you do feel it's getting a little bit uneasy again. But this week's news is all about Canada, not the UK.
Yes, and I think it's probably, well, like you say, it's sort of a repetition of the uncertainty that happened a few years ago. But when HMV UK was taken over by Hilco, everyone said, well, that's good, because look what Hilco have done for HMV Canada. They really turned that around.
Yeah, so that's interesting, isn't it? So this Hilco company owns both HMV UK and owned HMV Canada. But they didn't acquire the Canadian business when HMV went under. They got it 2 years prior.
They bought HMV Canada from HMV UK.
Yeah, when HMV UK was desperately trying to sell off everything in order to raise some cash, because they knew the end was nigh. And so they sold off Waterstones, didn't they? And various other assets, all the live stuff they bought, the Mama companies and venues that they bought. They sold all of that off. And as part of that, they sold HMV Canada to Hilco. And as you say, then when Hilco subsequently, 2 years later, bought the UK business, some people were saying, oh, they seem to be turning the Canadian business around. So if they can do what they did in Canada over here, perfect. But seemingly not.
Seemingly not, because HMV Canada has gone into receivership and is in the process of shutting down. In fact, will be gone entirely by the 30th of April.
And it's not that they're saying, oh, we've brought in the administrators or whatever they would call them in Canada, and they're going to try and sell it as a going concern.
No.
It really is fire sale. And it'll be, I remember, when, do you remember Borders? It was more of a bookshop, but they always had a really good music department. And I remember going into the one in Islington on the weekend they went under and they were completely shutting down. And they were selling the shelving. They were literally selling everything in the building. And you sort of sense that that is what it's going to be like at HMV, which actually still has a pretty big network of stores. It's just over 100 stores, isn't it, across Canada? Yeah, and they're all going. So this all happened last week in the courts.
Yeah, on Friday, the Ontario Superior Court ruled that, that was it. They'd had enough of HMV Canada and it should go away.
Now, Hilco was owed quite a lot of money by HMV Canada. Don't quite know how the deal was structured, so that came about.
There's $56 million in outstanding debts across all creditors, but Hilco is a sizable part of that.
So a lot of money is owed, and seemingly there were some last-minute talks to try and restructure the relationship with key suppliers. So that would mean the major record companies, the studios who provide the DVDs and all of that. But that came to nothing. And so they basically shut it down, and Hilco were writing it off and sort of washing their hands of it. Meanwhile, the boss of HMV Canada, it was Billboard he was talking to?
Yes, he gave quite an open interview, a candid interview to Billboard, because what's he got to lose now?
And he's been there ever since Hilco took over, actually probably before, by what he's saying.
Yeah, he used to be HMV UK, and then he moved over just before Hilco took over. In fact, possibly a couple of years before Hilco took over. And then he's been there ever since, obviously, and is now overseeing the shutting down of that. Whether he'll come back and work for HMV UK, who knows? He's probably had enough of HMV by now.
And indeed, entertainment retail in general, perhaps.
He didn't sound too up. Actually, he was quite up on the future HMV could have had, and was more down on the suppliers, which I think that's a story we've seen before. When the UK business was struggling, they were like, oh, the suppliers need to renegotiate so that we've got better terms, and then everything will be fine. But I mean, there's only so far that the suppliers can go. And that's what, I mean, he talked about that in this interview, saying that, you know, they really needed the major labels and the major movie studios to renegotiate terms so that they'd be in a more financially stable position. But they couldn't get all of them on board, and they needed to have all of them on board to be able to do this. And that was the main reason why the company had ultimately failed.
Yeah, and I suppose, I mean, when Hilco bought HMV UK, they sought to renegotiate the deals with the key suppliers. And a lot of that is risk, as into, you know, is it sale or return? When does the money change hands and all of that sort of stuff? And they did that in Canada when they took the Canadian business over. But by the sounds of this interview, they never managed to persuade certain key suppliers. It sounded like they had more problem on the DVD movie side than they did on the music side.
Yeah.
Which is probably because, I mean, I don't know about Canada. Certainly in the UK 4 years ago. It'd be interesting to know if the same thing happened now, whether now the majors have sort of moved on. But certainly 4 or 5 years ago, when HMV UK was sort of skidding towards oblivion, you really sensed the majors desperately wanted it to stay in business. And although they clearly didn't want to saddle all of the risk and hand over loads of money, at the same time, they were willing to be flexible because they wanted to continue to have a presence on the high street that wasn't just in BHS and the supermarkets. But certainly, what this guy was saying, in Canada, some key suppliers wouldn't play ball. And it sounded like the result of that was they just didn't stock those suppliers' product. So they had gaps in the big releases that obviously everyone's going in to buy.
And then that's clearly a problem. If that's your key product, then not having it is definitely an issue.
And certainly...
And we'll send out a message to your customers that it's not looking good.
And I suppose, certainly in the old days, the way entertainment retail worked was there were those big releases during the year, whether they were music releases or DVD or gaming releases, the big new products that would get lots of people in store. And the hope was, once you got them in store for the big release, while they were there, they would then spend another £50, $50 on stuff that they didn't know they wanted once they're in store. So you need those big releases to get the mainstream audience in your shop so you can sell them other stuff.
Yeah, and actually, well, he talked about young people. That was an interesting bit of the Billboard interview. Nick Williams, who was saying that young people, this generation, don't really want to buy like physical products. They don't want CDs and DVDs. They're not interested in them.
And we know that.
So they had to find other ways to get them into the shop and buy stocking like T-shirts and other fashion things and kind of pop culture items. Those help get people in the store. Having vinyl in the store really helped in the last couple of years, he said, but clearly not enough. It's still the business was still CD and DVD.
And I suppose it was interesting because obviously HMV UK in its final few years prior to the administration and the Hilco acquisition, when Simon Fox came in as CEO, and his strategy was diversification. We have to sell other product lines. And he dabbled with fashion, did quite a lot in tech, didn't they? Trying to get a gadget place that never really worked. But Canada seemingly tried to do something similar. I suppose, I think HMV UK spent a lot of money trying to diversify, and then that, in the end, what was on one level a sensible strategy ended up running a whole load of debts that probably escalated the collapse in the end. You felt the Canadian business was being a little bit more sensible and step-by-step and more logical things like, I mean, Record Shops have always sold T-shirts, but expanding the sort of the merch side of the business and then trying to play on the vinyl revival. But yes, well, it was interesting, wasn't it? Because on some part of the interview, he seemed to be saying, but it just didn't work. And then another time in the interview, he was sort of saying, oh, but it could have worked if only we could have restructured these deals and had a couple more years to sort of further with the diversification.
But to be fair, he is right in the middle of it still. And those two conflicts probably are playing on his mind quite a lot. And I would imagine it'll be quite a long time after it's all shut down. He'd really be able to look back and go, yeah, that wasn't working and it needed to go. But yeah, at the moment, he's probably like, oh, if we could have, if he'd just given us 6 more months... it could have turned it around.
Obviously, digital is booming in Canada. HMV did dabble in Canada with a streaming service and a download service that never really took off. I mean, none of HMV's attempts. I mean, over the years, they've tried so many times to launch a digital product. They always seem to arrive just too late and never capture the imagination. So digital is really booming in Canada. And I suppose, well, it's twofold, isn't it? CD sales continue to decline. Vinyl revival generally gets overhyped. I mean, it's interesting, but it's certainly not replacing CDs. And so that maybe ultimately means those big retail chains are going to go. I mean, HMV UK at the moment is very much saying business as usual, doesn't affect ours, nothing to do with ours. But you do sort of feel, well, they've not managed to build a digital business. Okay, they're trying to diversify, but they've not become like Urban Outfitter type shops. I mean, when you go in, well, I only ever go shopping in the week before Christmas. It's the only time I go into any shops that aren't a supermarket or a pound shop. But I did think pre-Christmas this year, as I went into various bookshops, and then I did go into an HMV. And it's weird that going into a bookshop doesn't feel antiquated and old, like going into an HMV-type record shop feels. Mm. When you go into an HMV-type record shop, I mean, OK, if you go to Rough Trade East, it's sort of, you know, it's like in a warehouse and there's lots of music fans there and there's normally somebody playing some music. And that sort of still feels like it's part of being a real music fan now. Whereas going into a sort of more H&B type store, it just feels like, this feels like we're in 1998. Whereas when I go into a bookshop, well, you could say, well, surely everyone's moving over to ebooks, blah, blah, blah. But somehow a bookshop doesn't feel weird in the way that a sort of an old school high street record shop does.
And I don't think people are moving over to ebooks in the way that people are moving over to downloads and streaming.
Yeah, I mean, now that's almost certainly part of it. But I suppose it's sort of two sides to this, which is, I think, the continued slow decline of CDs, DVD and gaming. DVD actually a little bit faster at the moment, and physical product gaming still. They're all going down. So you do sort of feel you reach a point where actually it will become impractical to have these sort of sizable networks of stores like the old school HMV networks. And then the flip side of that is, we talked last year about how in some markets, including here in the UK, CD sales were higher than you probably would have thought they would be. Had you been asked 10 years ago, where would the CD market be in 2015? Probably not still over a third of the UK recorded music market, which it was. However, sort of slowly CD sales declining could shut down a big chunk of the shops, and then those, you know, if 100 HMV Canada stores disappear overnight, you have to think that that will then further escalate the decline of CDs. So you'll see another slump in sales of CDs, because while clearly not enough people wanted those CDs to keep the shops in business, there was still an audience there who were going into HMV on a semi-regular basis, buying CDs they didn't know they wanted. Where will they go next? Will they go to Amazon and do mail order? Or will they just say, well, that's it, it's time to stop collecting CDs, it's time to finally embrace something digital? Who knows?
We'll see. But I mean, I guess the official line that came out in HMV Canada's statement last week was that Canada has experienced more significant declines in CD and DVD sales in each of the last 2 years than has been seen in most other major markets, which is an interesting quote. Like you say, digital is booming in Canada.
At last, it took quite a long time.
Spotify came to Canada much later than most other kind of big music markets, Western music markets. And possibly Canada is experiencing something that actually everywhere else experienced a few years prior.
Yes, so there shouldn't have been a 100 network HMV Canada still going in 2017 that probably you would have expected the streamlining to happen, so there were 20 stores left or something like that. But I suppose, you know, Hilco there making it very specific to Canada, they may well be right to do so, but you also sense perhaps what you're meant to infer from that is the UK's fine. Also, I mean, the other thing that HMV have sort of been doing on the side in recent years is doing licensing deals around their brand in other markets, particularly sort of like some of the Middle Eastern markets or some emerging markets. And so perhaps that's a code for them saying it's all fine in the UK. And, oh, these people we're negotiating these licensing deals with in Asia, yeah, you'll still be fine. Still give us money to use our brand. But who knows? So interesting times on the old high street retail side of music.
Still to come this week, we're going to look at some more of this week's music industry news in brief and answer a listener question. But first, I thought we'd have a little chat about an article you wrote this week, Chris.
Yeah.
Do you want to chat about an article you wrote?
All of them. Do you want me to list every article I've written this week?
No, we don't have time for that. I was thinking of one specifically, which was your article on who could be the music industry's enemy number one in 2017.
Yes, this was the first CMU Trends article of the year. CMU Trends now back up and running for our premium subscribers. Give us some money. Why don't you? It's only £5 a month. It's a bargain. And you get access to CMU Trends on the weekly news digest,
and
discounts
in fact,
on all of our events. So go to the website and go premium. That's what I say.
Yeah.
Although...
Yeah, this article's free.
This one's a free read sample.
So that was a waste of time.
So you don't need to pay us to read this. So I had a think over the Christmas break of who I thought could be contenders for enemy number one of the music industry in 2017. Because it sort of feels like YouTube was undeniably enemy number one of certainly the music rights industry,
for
the labels and the publishers in 2016. That was the one that they kept banging on about and laying into in ever-increasingly overt ways. So everyone hated YouTube. And then probably second to that was secondary ticketing. On the live side, particularly in the artist community, the secondary ticketing sites were the big enemies. But I thought, OK, well, what about 2017? So I came up with five contenders.
Yep, you've already mentioned two of them.
I did my work. So I think if we quickly run through the five contenders, then you should do your work and pick enemy number one for 2017.
OK.
Out of these five.
Cool.
So In order to get my rationale behind each of these five, you should go and read the article at completemusicupdate.com. But quickly, YouTube could still be enemy number one this year because all of the issues with YouTube are unresolved. And although part of me feels that, you know how we often diss the music industry's opposition of YouTube on this podcast?
Yeah.
When I was giving a lecture to the students at the Notting Hill Music Academy the other day, I sort of ended up being on the other side of the table and I was completely defending the label's stance and laying into YouTube.
As so often happens.
So completely ended up on the other side of the argument. But part of me still feels that the issues that the music industry has with YouTube... So the fact that YouTube won't pay minimum guarantees per stream, so their licensing deals just are revenue share. They don't have the minimum guarantees that a Spotify or an Apple Music deal has with the record companies and the music publishers and the collecting societies. So that the different aspects of the YouTube deal and the whole safe harbors stuff that sort of enables that, that increases YouTube's negotiating power. Although there is the article in the draft European Copyright Directive, which in theory could alter safe harbors in Europe, although... I don't think it will in a radical way, certainly not in a way that will automatically overnight change things for YouTube. So I sort of feel that ultimately the music industry will learn to live with YouTube, and that's sort of what YouTube are hoping. If they can just keep procrastinating around this for another few years, eventually the paid-for streaming services will all take off and those will be successful. More advertising money will come in. The advertising industry will learn how to do five-second ads, which is really what you need in order for advertising to work on a platform like YouTube. And eventually, everyone will just learn to live with YouTube, paying nominal revenue share royalties with no minimum guarantees. And just like everyone shut up about file sharing, even though file sharing never went away, everyone will shut up about YouTube. And I still sort of feel that that could happen, unless something radical happens with the European Copyright Directive as it works its way through Parliament and Council. Although I think eventually the music industry probably will learn to live with YouTube, I don't think that's going to happen in 2017.
No.
I think the ranting will continue. My assumption is... that in April, when we get the useful book of stats from the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry, which will tell us that the record industry had a good year in 2016, growth actually accelerated compared to 2015, streaming is booming in a major way, and look at the vinyl revival, isn't that great? Public performance is still doing pretty well. Oh, but what about YouTube? YouTube's screwing everything up. It's all going to pop because of YouTube.
It would have been so much better without YouTube.
I suspect is what we'll hear from the
standard
in April
trade body quote at the moment.
But number two nominee for enemy number one of 2017, part of me feels that the one thing that could take the heat off YouTube this year is Facebook.
Yeah.
In that all of the issues that apply with YouTube sort of apply with Facebook too. At least YouTube shares the advertising income it's bringing in with the content owners. It might not do minimum guarantees. We might not be happy with how much money that equates to. But at least there is a revenue share deal on the table. And most labels and publishers are, albeit reluctantly, getting that money in. Whereas over on Facebook at the moment, there ain't no monetization. It's not an option. Even though the kids are uploading both music videos and videos containing the music industry's audio on an increasingly prolific basis.
Facebook might not obviously be a YouTube competitor, although I think it's becoming, well, not more obviously so, that's not the right word, but the music industry is noticing more that its content is up there unmonetized.
And Facebook have just headhunted a YouTube exec to try and sort out the licensing on Facebook. Although my assumption is that probably their starting point is going to be, can we have the same deal as YouTube and we'll set up... Well, they have their rights manager, don't they? Which we'll talk more about in a bit. Mm. But they could turn it into Content ID, ad monetization, as well as takedown. So we'll make our technology like YouTube's, we'll do deals like YouTube, and it'll be like, what, you mean those deals we've been slagging off for the last 2 years? I suppose, as I say in the article, the one difference is that... although video content is increasingly high profile within Facebook and within the Facebook feed and more music content is going up there, it is still a different experience to YouTube in that you don't go to Facebook looking for a specific video or looking for a specific track in the way you do with YouTube.
Yeah.
It just pops up in your feed. So obviously YouTube has always said, oh, well, we're as much a marketing platform as we are a streaming platform. And that's what Facebook will say. But potentially Facebook have a better argument because the problem with YouTube saying, oh, well, we're a marketing platform, so you should be happy with the lower royalties, is it's like, yeah, but you're also a streaming platform. So what are we marketing? You know, people will come, sample the track on YouTube, and then listen to it again on YouTube and again on YouTube, rather than going and paying on Spotify or Apple, wherever. Whereas with Facebook, that's not the user experience yet. So I think Facebook possibly do have a stronger argument to say we're a marketing platform. And if the labels think that by helping Facebook become a marketing platform, that will reduce the marketing power of YouTube, then potentially there's a deal to be done there. But there are plenty of people in the music community who are starting to think, do you know what, actually, Facebook's more of a problem than YouTube.
Also, the history of the music industry, or the record industry, the rights industry, is littered with stories of the labels or the publishers, mainly the labels, I guess, saying, let's work to give this company more power so we take away the power
of another
this company over here
like.
We don't like. And then that company becomes more powerful, and then it's the cycle happening again. It's pretty much what happened with YouTube. So
and MTV before
and MTV
it.
Before
and the big
it.
Retailers before that.
Yeah, so Facebook could indeed, it could really be shooting themselves in the foot to do that. But history tells us that that is what they will do.
And that could mean that Facebook are enemy number one by the end of 2017. Now, the issue of YouTube and Facebook is that they're potentially taking people away from services like Spotify, which are super duper. They pay loads of money. They pay minimum guarantees. You know, most of that growth that we're seeing in the record industry, really, it's Spotify money and it's Apple Music money that is driving all of that. Spotify's brilliant, but I still thought that perhaps they could be a contender for enemy number one in 2017.
Well, especially as their IPO is
yes.
looming.
So we reckon that they will float at some point this year. Certainly, they borrowed some money. Was that a year ago, 18 months ago?
Getting on,
So they took a bit of debt financing rather than equity financing that was structured in such a way that it gets more expensive for them to service that debt the longer the IPO is put off.
Yeah.
So therefore, you have to think IPO is now very much on the agenda, and that will really put the glare of Wall Street and the music industry on the whole Spotify business model and where it's going and whether or not Spotify can be a profitable business and whether or not it will have to change its relationship with the music industry in order to become profitable. They're already trying to renegotiate their deals with the record companies, and I think all of that scrutiny could result in there being more tension. Because obviously there are already parts of the music community, mainly the artist and songwriter community, more so than labels and publishers, who are down on Spotify. You've got the whole fallout over mechanical royalties in the US that continues to rumble on behind the scenes. So there are already some people in the music community who are down on Spotify. But who knows, as the IPO goes through the motions, could there be more critics? Plus, of course, Spotify is becoming very powerful, and sort of what you alluded to earlier,
yeah.
The music industry never likes people who are powerful, even if they are the cash cow that is keeping everybody going.
Well, it's like you said, you know, when it looked like HMV was going to go under in the UK, you really felt the major labels, and a lot of the independent labels as well, like they all came out and said, oh my God, we love HMV, we don't want this to go out of business. But, you know, 10 years previously, they hated HMV.
I mean, the thing is, if you go back certainly to the 1990s, you know, the things that everyone hated in the UK was HMV, Virgin Megastore and MTV. Even though at the same time, they would have entire teams of people schmoozing all the decision makers at HMV and Virgin Megastore and MTV because they wanted to get their product in front of everybody. But they don't like the fact that those small number of organisations have the power, and so they grumble about it. And of course, you know, the independents grumble because inevitably the majors usually have an advantage with those organisations because they've got marketing spend that they can spend with those organisations. And so there is a long history of that. It's probably inevitable. It's just sort of human nature. But I mean, Spotify and whichever other streaming services manage to succeed on a global basis, of which Apple Music is the main contender beyond Spotify. I mean, it used to be that in the UK, HMV, Virgin Megastore, MTV were the really dominant players in retail and media. Well, Spotify is both retail and media, and it's global. Its dominance is I mean, not truly global, because there'll be some markets where it won't take off, but I mean, in a lot of key markets, they are the dominant player. So there will be less of these people for the music industry to hate. So rather than hating people on a sort of country-by-country basis, it will be global hatred of the people with the power. And there are already some people who are upset that Spotify are increasingly controlling curation on the platform. So whereas in the early days, Spotify didn't seem to be interested in creating playlists itself, it encouraged labels to do it and media to do it, and indeed random users to share their playlists. That was sort of how curation worked. And then Spotify decided, no, we're going to do curation. Some of that will be automated. We'll also hire teams of people and we'll start doing human-led curation. And now they're really pushing that to the fore, which is how they're becoming media as well as retail. And some people aren't happy with the fact that that is completely overshadowing, you know, the label playlists and the media playlists in the way Spotify positions stuff. And there's already some tensions around that. So on one level, everyone will love Spotify because it will continue to be the cash cow, but there could be some tensions on the peripheries or indeed in the centre as well.
Number four on our list, American radio.
So this is in some ways skewed towards the US, which is, of course, the biggest recorded music market.
In almost all ways.
Except that the issues around American radio and the way American radio is licensed has been getting increased attention from the music community outside of the US. So, for example, the fact that the record industry earns zero from AM, FM radio in the US because of a weird little bit of American copyright law, there's been a campaign against that for a few years now in America. And the most recent push in Washington, you had organisations and artist groups outside of the US also backing that and saying it's mad that American AM FM radio isn't paying the same royalties that their counterparts everywhere else in the world do. There are various issues of American radio on the recording side, also on the publishing side. We've talked about sort of the consent decrees here on the podcast. We've talked about global music rights, upcoming legal battle with the American radio stations over how they pay publishing rights and whether or not global music rights, with its 73 songwriters, is somehow a monopoly, which is what the American radio industry is alleging. So I think all of those tensions are going to continue. There will be some lawsuits this year. There will be lobbying will continue and may increase this year. So I think, although it is sort of a US-specific issue, it does have an impact worldwide. And I think, you know, certainly collecting societies and trade bodies and maybe artists outside of the US will probably continue to have opinions on these issues as they go through the motions. And Irving Azoff, who set up Global Music Rights, obviously he led in America on the YouTube campaign last year, getting all those veteran artists that he's worked with to come out and say, oh, YouTube, bad. So you could well see the same thing if the legal battle between GMR and the US radio industry gets to court.
And finally, secondary ticketing,
which I alluded to as probably enemy number two of the music industry in 2016. Of course, this is the interesting one because it sort of pitches the music industry against the music industry because one of the big players in second ticketing is Live Nation with its ticketing business. So Seatwave and Get Me In here in the UK. They have others elsewhere in the world. So we have a major, major player in the music industry, in live, in artist management, is one of the big players in secondary ticketing. Actually, it sort of feels that StubHub get most of the heat because I think perhaps they're certainly in the last year, they've been particularly prolific here in the UK with their advertising and their sort of posters, and they have lots of presence at certain venues. Whereas a few years ago, Viagogo seemed to have an edge in that respect. It does feel like now StubHub are the most sort of up there and out there, and therefore they're feeling the heat. And of course, there was the whole debacle when they sponsored the Q Awards last year. Although, as I say, on some levels, Live Nation's second ticketing business is more interesting because that's the music community versus the music community. But obviously, we've talked a lot on the podcast about the Fanfare Alliance here in the UK. Similar campaigns are sort of springing up elsewhere around the world, some being led by the music industry, some by the political community. And I sort of feel at the moment, most of the second ticketing campaigns have been fought on a country-by-country basis, generally seeking regulation within each country to try and constrain or limit secondary ticketing. If those various campaigns could join up and become global, and if all the artists who are supporting those national campaigns could go global, then I think that could almost become a bigger talking point and issue than all of the music rights, streaming, digital stuff that we spoke about earlier. So, Andy Malt, who are you going with?
Well, it's a tricky choice, isn't it? I mean, secondary ticketing, that really felt like that campaign got going last year and started making some headway, and in fact it did make, you know, there were some legislative changes were made that they've been trying to push through for years.
Some of them are still in the process of being made.
Some of them are in the process still. Still, I guess, still feels like there's a way to go before that campaign really gets going in the US. And if it did get going in the US and really went up against Live Nation, then that would be a big thing for secondary ticketing in the campaign against it. American radio, although, like you say, does have a global implication, I still think it's quite US-focused. Spotify is an interesting one. If and when they IPO and they have
public shareholders who are pushing for profits, and Spotify has to go to the record labels and say, we want to give you less money, or we at least want to get rid of the minimum guarantees.
Or we want to start charging you for playlist placement, which they've always said they won't do. But that's basically what... That's why people hated HMV and Virgin. They used to charge you for decent racking.
Yeah. And when look at what happened when Pandora IPO'd. Pandora was enemy number one for a year or two after that. Facebook, that is a growing thing that could blow up this year. And YouTube, that's ongoing. Like you said, there are things happening with that. But will anything happen this year? Or will the industry have to keep up the pressure? I think that probably the chances are the industry will have to keep up the pressure, but will lose a bit of wind from its sails because who can be bothered? So that will more be kind of an ongoing thing that people don't pay. You won't get the same big artist-led campaigns and letters being signed, probably. So I don't know. I don't know. Could be any one of them. That's not a good answer, though.
Well, let's pick one. It could be any one of them. You're right. Which one? Bearing in mind you were wrong about the Digital Economy Act letter sending. So you've already lost that competition that began in 2012.
Well,
on the podcast.
I think if you look at exactly what I said on that, then I don't think I was wrong. I think it will be secondary ticketing.
I think Facebook. So let's resume at the end of the year and see who got the most heat in 2017. Meanwhile, CompleteMusicUpdate.com. Read the article in full.
Just quickly, time to look through a few of this week's other news stories in brief. The Prince estate is embroiled in some beefs.
Yes, the sort of litigation around the Prince estate is starting to gain momentum. And the first 6 months after Prince's very sad, untimely death, everyone seems to be getting on, but it is now sort of all falling apart. And so there's various disputes. The dispute with Tidal continues.
And that's really building up partly, well, obviously, because there are suits and countersuits with that. But it's generally thought that Prince's music is going to return to all streaming services on the night of the Grammys on the 12th of February. Spotify took out some adverts in New York. Just purple posters with the Spotify logo on that suggests that it's got Prince's music again.
And what we discovered this week through a legal filing is that Tidal / Roc Nation, Jay-Z's company, has been asking to see the deals that are being done with other companies to see whether or not they feel they conflict with the arrangement they feel they had with Prince before he died.
Well, exclusive access to his catalogue. And if putting Prince's music on Spotify is definitely... doesn't chime with an exclusivity deal.
And the other thing a legal filing this week seemed to imply was, I think we talked about on the podcast last year, that the estate sued Tidal, basically saying, you're streaming the entire Prince catalogue on an exclusive basis. We can only find paperwork for the penultimate album.
Yeah.
And you claim you have all these other rights. And now transpires that there was also deals with Roc Nation. So it feels like he did deals with Roc Nation that then sort of meant that there were licensing deals with Tidal, them all sort of being interlinked businesses. So it's a little bit more complicated. And basically what the judge said this week is there is enough of a problem here that this should proceed and the court should continue to consider this. So the estate can't dismiss Tidal's claims against the estate just yet. And then there is still some wrangling going on between the heirs, who I think we said last week are accusing the bank and the individuals who are administrating the estate of screwing up a tribute concert, and then the bank who were doing that have hit back this week and was saying, well, it was sort of saying, we said at the time that we knew nothing about concerts.
we're a bank.
And we said we're having nothing to do with this, so you can't come back to us now and pretend that we screwed it up. So, yeah, lots of Prince wrangling. I sort of feel that this is going to continue to sort of drip feed on in the coming weeks and months.
I think the problem with the Prince estate and kind of pulling that apart and disseminating it to his heirs is that there's quite a complex situation with his heirs.
There's a split
between them.
And, Four on one side, two on the other.
Yeah, and no one has quite the... Obviously, he didn't have any children... No one has quite the strong claim to be his heir that, say, and like Michael Jackson's children would. So that's it's going to continue being quite messy, I think.
Yes, and I suppose whereas the Michael Jackson estate had to deal with a lot of litigation, but that was all litigation that began when Jackson was still alive that they had to sort out, whereas it feels that this is all new litigation that's coming in as the heirs and the various people involved in the estate disagree. So more of that this week and more to come, I'm sure.
We talked about warning letters going out to file sharers. last week.
Here in the UK.
Here in the UK. America's system for doing that has just been wound down.
Yes.
Because so, file sharing in the US is a thing of the past.
It is. No more file sharing in America. The Copyright Alert System, which was launched a few years ago, has a lot of parallels to what the ISPs and the music and movie industries are about to start here in the UK. Although that was a voluntary deal. It wasn't a result of any change in the law. They've been doing it for a few years now, basically forwarding on warning letters. Actually, in some cases, quite stern warning letters that the record companies and the movie studios were sending via the ISPs. There's been talk for a couple of years now, oh, we're reviewing this. And then finally last week they said, yeah, we reviewed it, no more. So, yeah, be interesting to see whether or not the music and movie industry have any other anti-piracy plans behind the scenes. Certainly they were pushing for web blocking like we have here in the UK, which obviously the last time web blocking was on the agenda in America, the internet shut down for a day.
Yeah.
But you do sense certainly the movie industry is sort of getting ready to have a second go at that. Perhaps they can sneak it through with all the chaos that's happening in Washington at the moment. We'll see.
Yeah, I think that the people who protested web blocking last time are a bit distracted with all the other...
Worrying about the collapse of human civilization.
Yeah. And over here in the UK again, we talked about the Digital Economy Bill a bit in recent podcasts. A new amendment to that has been proposed by Liberal Democrat Lord Tim Clement Jones on transparency and getting more information for artists on where their money is and has been.
Yes, so this is the new Digital Economy Bill rather than the one 6 years ago that brought the letter sending that's about to start into law. So it's a sort of miscellaneous catch-all bit of legislation, sort of classic Parliament. Anything to do with the internet gets covered in this one piece of legislation. And Lord Clement Jones has proposed this amendment. So the DEB went through the Commons last year. It's now working its way through the House of Lords. And the amendment he has proposed is one of many, many amendments that have been proposed in the Lords. Basically is to try and put some pressure on record companies and music publishers and book publishers. It isn't just music industry specific, where a creator or an artist has assigned their copyrights to another party, but they're still a beneficiary through contract, that they have certain rights to get information. And I mean, most artists get certain information under their existing record contract and certain auditing rights, but to basically push a little bit more transparency so that artists and songwriters and other creators have a right to go and find out how their copyrights are being exploited and what's happening to the money as it works through the system. All of this, obviously, the Dissecting the Digital Dollar report that we produced for Music Managers Forum last year, in many ways, this was the single biggest issue for the management community. The fact that some labels share some information, and that's great, but as a general rule, there's lots of mysteries and ambiguity about what happens to digital income, and the managers are putting pressure on their business partners to get better, but if they won't, can we get sort of changes in copyright law to help? And obviously, there's also transparency measures in the European Copyright Directive that's going through Brussels at the moment, but this is a sort of, well, I think Lord Clement Jones wanted to put it on the Westminster agenda now rather than waiting 3 years for the directive to get all caught up in Brexit and all of that. Because, you know, for the artist community, it's a big issue.
So you can read all of those stories if you go to completemusicupdate.com/podcast, find the show notes for this show. All the links will be in there. So finally this week, we're going to answer one of your questions, listeners. And this question is sort of a follow-up to something we did a couple of weeks ago on Facebook and videos on Facebook.
Yes, so this question actually was handed to me. I went and talked at both BIM in London and the Notting Hill Music Academy this week. Very interesting to talk to the students there. And this is a question that came up at the latter related to Facebook. And, so read out the question again.
So the question is, I post video clips alongside my music reviews on Facebook, but they keep getting taken down. Is what I'm doing wrong?
So this was a guy who reviews music on a blog, and then he basically uploads 30-second clips that he has taken from usually from the official YouTube video onto his Facebook profile with a link through to his review. And one of the reasons the question came up is because in my talk at the Notting Hill Academy of Music, we were talking about copyright law, and then we spent a little bit of time talking about copyright exceptions. So, we all know that if you own the copyright in a song or a recording, you get a load of controls with the copyright. So, as the copyright owner, you have the exclusive rights to copy and distribute and adapt and communicate and perform the song or the recording that you own. And that's what copyright is about. However, There are a handful of exceptions, certain scenarios, where other people can actually make use of your song or your recording without coming and getting permission from you. So the controls are basically put on hold in certain scenarios. And one of those is critical analysis. And so that is a copyright exception that basically says, if you show a clip of something, so whether it's a track or a movie or a TV show, in order to then critique it, then there's a copyright exception there. So you don't actually need to go and get specific permission or a license from the copyright owner. And that's a sort of a free speech thing, because if you think about it, if you think of the film programme on BBC One, is there still a film programme on BBC One?
Yes.
I still use this as my example, but who presents it now?
Mark Kermode, I think.
Oh, has Mark Kermode got it?
I saw his face on iPlayer the other day as I skipped past.
That might be what it was.
He might have been standing in, or he might have just been a guest, I don't know.
Anyway, the film programme on BBC One, so it's been the same format for 87 years now. They show a clip of a movie and then Barry Norman slags it off. He did last time I watched it. And or he might say it's great, but sometimes they show a bit of a movie and then they slag it off. And under the true rules of copyright, in order to show the clip, you'd have to go and get permission, because that would be at the very least a communication, possibly a reproduction as well. So you'd have to go and get permission from the studio, and they would say, well, are you going to be polite about our movie? And you would say, no, I'm going to slag it off. And they would say, well, you can't have our clip then. And so obviously that's not going to work. So to stop that from happening, there's this copyright exception that says that providing it's a snippet of the work and you then critique it, then you don't need to get permission. And it's called the critical analysis exception. So in theory, if you are posting a snippet of a track and then you are immediately reviewing it, you should be covered by the critical analysis exception, which therefore means that your content shouldn't be getting blocked when you upload it onto Facebook. However, a couple of asides. I mean, ultimately, we mentioned this earlier in the previous section, Facebook launched this thing called Rights Manager, which is its version of Content ID, so YouTube's content management system, so rights owners. Not all rights owners like YouTube, so at the moment big rights owners can go into the Facebook system and say, we own all these songs, we own all these recordings, if people upload them, we don't want them on your platform, so block them.
Yeah.
And whereas with Content
or
ID...
leave them but put adverts on them and give us the money.
Well, that's what you can do on Content ID.
But no, it's not on Facebook.
Can't do on Facebook. So the monetization element is not yet available on Facebook. So whereas with YouTube, generally most labels and publishers these days are like, well, just monetize it and give us some money, rather than blocking it. Whereas on Facebook, that's not an option. So there are certainly some music publishers we know are getting quite prolific now at blocking content on Facebook because they can't earn any money off it and they don't want it up there. And so I'm guessing that that is why these videos are getting blocked. And it probably is an automated process. It's not that somebody's going in and looking at those and saying, oh, we don't want that, block it, block it, block it. It's just that someone has logged their recordings or their songs with the system and it's automatically blocking the content as it goes up. Even though there is an argument to say that under this principle of the copyright exception of critical analysis, they shouldn't be blocking it. Now, they could argue, because I don't think he's actually putting the reviews underneath. He's putting
just
the title
link
of the review and a link. And so technically, you could probably say that's not strictly...
The Facebook post itself is not the critique.
Correct. Having said that, if you were to put edited highlights of the review and that it worked as a critique in itself, you'd have to get a lawyer to actually write this a proper bit of advice down on this. But I think there would definitely be a case if you were putting highlights of your review underneath to say, it's a 30-second clip, here's my review, that is protected by the critical analysis exception, therefore you can't take my content down. And in the US, where the takedown system, whether it's YouTube or whoever's takedown system, it ultimately comes from the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, it actually says that copyright owners can't abuse the takedown systems in order to remove content when they don't actually have the rights to do so. And there is the famous case where Universal Music Publishing was sued by a woman who had filmed her very young child dancing to a Prince track, put it up on YouTube. Universal blocked it, had it taken down, and then she argued that was fair use. So it's a similar concept, a slightly wider concept in American copyright law. It was fair use to have the Prince track in the background with her child dancing, and therefore Universal, although they did control the copyright, didn't have the right to take it down in that case. And then under US law, if you abuse a takedown system, you can be sued for that. And Universal were sued for that. And somehow 10 years on, that's still working its way through the courts. Now, that's US law, not UK law. But I suppose the other issue is that whereas YouTube's Content ID is many years on and has been very developed, If your content gets taken down through Content ID as a content partner on YouTube, you can go in and say, well, hang on a second, who took it down? Why did they take it down? I don't think they can take it down. I think that this is fair use, and you can appeal and go through the process. Whereas, I've not uploaded much video to Facebook myself, but as I understand it, Facebook's rights manager is much less sophisticated. It's not available to everybody, and that's not an option available to people who are just uploading videos on a casual basis on Facebook. And the guy who I was talking to who asked this question, he also suspected that his entire Facebook account, or certainly the video element of his Facebook account, might have been blocked. Because probably he's had lots of takedowns, and often normally these systems, a certain number of takedowns, your account gets blocked. So there's all sorts of issues there, which is, I think there probably is a case for saying copyright exception, although there might be some legal ambiguities on that. But B, it's another example of where Facebook is playing massive catch-up on its rights management system, both for the record companies, the music publishers, but also for the people who are uploading the videos and then having their content blocked. It's another reason why Facebook will be enemy number one of the music industry and all content creators in 2017.
Well, we'll see.
We will see.
We'll see. But that is all we've got time for on this week's podcast.
We've got lots of events coming up in the next week, but there's been massive tube strikes, so I might have to postpone them all. So we're not going to plug them. Bloody tube strike.
Yeah, maybe we'll plug those another time. But just for now, let's say if you're listening to this podcast and you're not subscribed to it, think to yourself in your head there that you could be subscribing to this podcast to get it delivered to you automatically every week.
We'll bring it to your door.
Yeah, go on like iTunes or Audio Boom or Spotify or basically anywhere you can think of that you might get yourself a podcast, and subscribe to it, and that'll be nice and fun for you, and probably us as well. This podcast was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It was produced by Matt Petey, and for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an Unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
That's quite a nice noise.